Hello, this is the Archaeology News Weekly and I'm David Connolly. This news is brought to you in partnership between Stone Pages and the British Archaeological Jobs and Resources website. All the stories have been collected from various sources, and to view details on each story including the source, please see the Stone Pages website at news.stonepages.com. And now the main headlines from around the world are as follows. A Bronze Age excavation in Kuwait enters a new phase. The pressure group says that the proposed land train to Stonehenge is too intrusive. The Highways Agency and English Heritage signed a historic agreement. And visualising the past in 3D, a new project is unveiled by Wessex Archaeology. A new dig shows that in Washington State, the place was inhabited over 8,000 years ago. And a Slovenian river is full of ancient treasures, but it's going fast, sadly. A 3,000-year-old dam revives a farming village in Turkey, and Paleolithic stone tools are found in China. Did the Aboriginal languages have Ice Age origins? And back to Britain again, the famous Sea Henge will hopefully be on display in 2008. Ancient Welsh forts are protected from a modern invasion, and have scientists solved the riddle of faces on Pacific artefacts? Finally, a 4,800-year-old artificial eye is discovered in Iran. The team from the Kuwait-Slovak Archaeological Mission is expected to embark on the third phase of their excavation project at the Al-Khidr site from the Bronze Age, situated on Failaka Island in Kuwait. The team of excavators are expected to return on site in February. Peter Barta, co-leader of the expedition, discussed some of the more interesting finds that the team had made throughout their previous two seasons. The burial, located in the middle of the settlement, was one of the most important discoveries the team unveiled earlier this year. Now, months after the discovery, the skeleton is to be dated using radiocarbon methods. Abundant evidence of basketry and cordage was also recognised in the bitumen imprints. Failaka, once a large settlement and sanctuary of the southern Arabian civilization, was a trading stop on the sea route between Mesopotamia and other civilizations from the Gulf in the first half of the second millennium BCE. Al-Khidr has been the least explored site of this legendary civilization of Dulmun, enriched by the control of trade in the whole region of the Gulf. According to Barta, the site features interesting finds related to the life of Bronze Age residents of the island. One part of the site was used for habitation and the other part was workshops, where evidence emerged about how they caught fish from the sea. The second phase of the excavations brought more information on the type of fishing techniques used, such as nets, hooks and ropes, that the inhabitants were all using. Local and imported pottery, as well as copper objects, arrowheads, knife-like objects and even sticks were recovered. Currently, the team is working on the analysis of obsidian, a type of volcanic glass, to find out whether it comes from Yemen, East Africa, or perhaps somewhere else. A proposal to run a land train as part of plans for the new £67 million Stonehenge Visitor Centre has come under fire during the second week of the Salisbury Public Inquiry. The aim is to use the train to transport tourists from the visitor centre to within walking distance of the ancient stones. But the chairman of the Stonehenge Alliance said that the trains would conflict with both national and international policies that seek to protect the landscape around the World Heritage Site. The Stonehenge Alliance is made up from a number of archaeological, environmental, transport, as well as pagan organisations that oppose the proposal for the visitor centre and road scheme. Archaeologist Dr. Kate Fielden gave evidence about the effect of the land train on the location, and she said that operating in the northeastern part of the site, it would be both visible and audibly intrusive, particularly at the King Barrow Ridge. The exceptional views will become further damaged by modern intrusions such as the A303, which already impinges. She added that financial considerations seem to be more important to English Heritage than what was best for the World Heritage Site, and that the current site was better for dispersal into the surrounding landscape. A Friends of the Earth representative, Kate Freeman, spoke about the transport arrangements for the visitor centre, saying that 581 car spaces proposed was exceptionally high and would lead to increased congestion, more queues, and would probably cause more problems for emergency vehicles. Well, the saga continues. The British Highways Agency will work with English Heritage to protect the historic environment. English Heritage and the Highways Agency signed an agreement on working together to protect it. The two bodies will now coordinate more closely in future to protect England's archaeology, according to the Memorandum of Understanding signed by Archie Robinson, Chief Executive of the Highways Agency, and Simon Thurley, Chief Executive of English Heritage. Receiving expert advice from English Heritage at an early stage of the planning process for transport schemes is the single biggest chance that has improved, not just the working relationship between the sectors, but the protection of the historic environment and the smooth running of construction projects. The agreement, building on an existing one from 1993, when the agency took over responsibility for funding cultural heritage work on motorways and trunk roads. Since then, however, policies relating to cultural heritage have changed radically. The new agreement comes at a time when debates still rage over what improvements will be made to the A344 and the A303 roads around Stonehenge. If the A303 is to be turned into a dual carriageway, as has been proposed by the Highways Agency, heritage groups, including English Heritage, have called for it to have an underground tunnel. However, predicted costs for this have soared, and some argue that both roads should stay as they are. The Highways Agency and Heritage advisers are continuing to look for a solution. Archaeologists at Wessex Archaeology have completed a 3D animation that reveals a prehistoric landscape now submerged under the English Channel, as it might have appeared 8,000 years ago. At the end of the last ice age, the River Arun in West Sussex flowed further 8 miles out into the what is now sea. Archaeological survey has revealed the lay of the land and what plants and trees grew there. The complex evidence has been turned into a compelling animated tour showing how the landscape might have looked and how families made a living from the land and the sea. The Seabed Prehistory Project was established to research ways of identifying evidence of prehistoric landscapes in and around aggregate dredging areas. The dredging provides many of the raw materials, such as gravel, needed for the building's industry. The project was designed to see if equipment that is commonly used by the offshore industry could also identify archaeological remains. It was an opportunity for archaeologists and the aggregate industry to work together to gain a better understanding of the archaeology beneath the sea. The results of this project will inform future proposals for new aggregate dredging licenses. The picture is built up with data collected as part of the project or inferred from other research. Geophysical survey identified the different geological layers in the study area, revealing the shape of the land, and vibrocores were used to gather evidence from the buried landscape. Vibrocores are tubes that are pushed deep into the seabed, and the column of sediment that is caught within the tube contains layers of ancient soils. The researchers were able to identify a layer of sediment dating to the Mesolithic period. The deposit corresponds with the geological layer found in the geophysical survey. Trapped within these layers were seeds and pollen from trees and plants that grew at the time. And by mapping where individual species were found, scientists were able to plot particular habitats and so build up a very detailed picture of the landscape. There's a video of this available on YouTube. Now, you have to listen carefully for this. It's www.youtube.com/watch?vTCGBNVI0GM0, and we hope you'll have a chance to watch that fascinating video. A new archaeological dig shows that Spokane area in Washington, USA, to be one of the oldest areas of continuous human habitation in the state. According to evidence verified by radiocarbon dating, people may have lived at the confluence of the Spokane River and the Lata Creek for some 8,000 years. Stanley Goff, archaeological director at Eastern Washington University, has been excavating a 25-by-60-foot site downstream from Spokane Falls. The findings are no surprise to Indian tribes in the area, whose oral history says ancient people fished along the river thousands of years ago. The oldest known habitation site in Washington is thought to be the Marms Rock Shelter, where evidence was found that it had been used for shelter, storage and burials for more than 11,000 years. Goff left a 5-month led a 5-month dig, and his team found over 60,000 artifacts, including spear tips known as Cascade Points, that were in use throughout the region as far back as 8,000 years ago. Radioactive carbon dating also showed 3 samples of charcoal 4 to 7 feet below the surface were also 8,000 years old. The dig was the result of a state order to install overflow tanks for sewer and stormwater lines for the city. The vast majority of the artifacts consisted of broken animal bone and stone flakes, but there was also arrow points made of obsidian, and these were from eastern Oregon, and an axe blade made of jade from the Wetanachi area. The dig uncovered rocks fashioned into weights for fishing nets at a layer indicating that they were around 3,500 years old. The weights indicate an effort to increase fish catching, either for drying and storage or even trading. No evidence of winter shelters was found, and the presence of bones from mammals that hibernate during the winter, such as marmots, indicate that humans were present only during the warm weather months. Diver and amateur archaeologist Andrzej Gaspary is haunted by the past. His hometown, the Lubyanka, has yielded thousands of artifacts, Celtic coins, Roman luxuries, medieval swords, all from a shallow 19-kilometre stretch. Those who lived near and travelled along the stream considered it sacred, Gaspary believes. That would explain why generations of Celts, Romans and other inhabitants offered up their treasures, far too many to be accidental. But Gaspary may never be able to explain for certain why the Lubyanka holds one of the richest stores of river treasures in Europe, many of them remarkably preserved by the soft sediments and gentle waters. Too many pieces of the puzzle have already disappeared. During the past 2 decades, sports divers have made the river their playground, removing most or some of the 10,000 to 13,000 objects found so far. Even though removing artifacts from the Lubyanka has long been illegal, professional archaeologists have been forced to compete with private collectors. Some divers sold to museums, others to the highest bidder. Some keep their treasures private. Many artifacts have left the country, and some are now untraceable. Gaspary's greatest torment comes from the knowledge that few of these maverick collectors know, or even care, where these prizes were found. For an archaeologist, an object's meaning comes as much from its context, location, association with other objects, as for the value itself. Without context, there's just no story. Mladen Muk is one of Gaspary's greatest tormentors. A Bosnian-born architect, he began diving the river in 1985 and has brought up around 1,000 pieces. In his kitchen in Ljubljana, a box contains prehistoric tools. Upstairs, dusty cases hold other rare artifacts, including 6,000-year-old deer antler axes. Muk says that he has no intention of selling what he's found and claims that they're better off with him than with the authorities, as more people see the artifacts in his house than if he gave them to a museum. Gaspary disagrees with that, however. A team at the National Museum of Slovenia is preparing an exhibition of the river's treasures that will tour Europe in 2008. And he is still hoping that someday Muk will hand over these items. I can only add my voice to that request. In Alachahuyuk, a central Turkish village, peasants and archaeologists celebrate a unique achievement. A 3,246-year-old dam, once buried under mud, is now back in service, irrigating farmlands. The dam is a heritage of the Hittites, who ruled over the vast areas of the Middle East from 2000 to 1000 BCE. They even fought against the great pharaoh Ramesses and built some of the biggest cities of the time in the heart of Anatolia. The 2,500 inhabitants of Alachahoyuk know the Hittites well. Since the early 20th century, archaeologists have been digging the remains of a royal city at the entrance to their village, around 160 kilometres east of Ankara. The dam, however, was unknown until 2002, when a team of Ankara University archaeologists began a new dig in the marshlands about 2 kilometres away. Assisted by the government and local authorities, the team removed 2.5 million cubic metres of mud from the site to recover the dam, and after some restoration, they put it back into operation. Built by a barren hill surrounded by poplars, the reservoir has a capacity to hold up to 30,000 cubic metres of water from subterranean streams. It also comes complete with a purifying pool to make sure the water is drinkable, as well as a selection of irrigation channels. It's the only dam in the world to have been repaired and put into its original purpose 3,240 years after its construction. It truly is unique. The dam wall of stone and natural clay was built in a way that experts say strikingly resembles modern-day construction techniques. And this shows that archaeology can benefit present-day people in a very, very practical way. Archaeologists have discovered 21 sites and thousands of stone tools dating back more than 20,000 years to the Paleolithic Age in northwest China's Shanxi province. Over 20,000 stone implements, including fine stone cores and other stone tools, were recovered. Compared with Europe, China has unearthed few decorative items from the Paleolithic Age. However, the archaeologists also discovered two pieces of ornaments made of clamshell. One is rectangular and the other fan-shaped. Aboriginal language may be older than people think, argues a linguist anthropologist who says they originated as far back as the end of the last ice age, around 13,000 years ago. This challenges existing thinking, which suggests Aboriginal languages developed from a proto-language that spread through Australia 5,000 to 6,000 years ago. The key to the new hypothesis is the prehistoric Australian landmass, when New Guinea and Tasmania were still attached some 13 to 28,000 years ago. Dr. Mark Clendon says in the journal Current Anthropology that the continent, known as Sahul, was relatively densely populated on the land bridge connecting northern Australia to New Guinea. The other populated area was along what is now Australia's eastern seaboard. The two population groups were separated by a vast, cold, windswept, arid stretch of land that covered most of the continent. The eastern group spoke a tongue that has become what is known today as Pamanyogen, and the Arafuran group spoke another language used today in northern Australia. He is suggesting that Pamanyogen and non-Pamanyogen languages go back 13,000 years to when there was a land bridge between New Guinea and Australia. Until now, the reason why these two Aboriginal language groups are so different, with a distinct grammar and vocabulary, has been a mystery. Around 11,000 years ago, what was the Arafura Plain was flooded by rising sea as the Ice Age ended. This caused the northern people to migrate into either New Guinea or the northern parts of Australia. Meanwhile, increased rainfall and warmer temperatures made inland parts of the continent more habitable and sparked a westward migration of eastern dwellers. His hypothesis provides an alternative picture to the traditional view that 6,000 years ago a single proto-language spread from the Gulf of Carpentaria around Australia, eventually giving rise to the existing Aboriginal languages. However, there are flaws in the argument, including one that there is only weak evidence of similarities between southern New Guinea and northern Aboriginal languages. Some experts remain to be convinced about Clendon's proposal. Conservation work on the Seahenge wooden circle is continuing apace, but it will be at least a year before the Bronze Age monument will be on display in Lynn in Norfolk, England. The 4,000-year-old structure was uncovered by waves on the beach at home in 1998, sparking frenzied interest in the archaeological community. In 1999, the pieces were excavated and preserved before they were handed to the Mary Rose Trust in Portsmouth for conservation, with the ultimate aim of putting them on display in Lynn. The pieces, chosen to go on display in Lynn Museum, are currently being removed from a waxy substance called PEG, which holds the wooden fibres together. Over the next 2 or 3 months, they will be freeze-dried to remove any remaining water before they're cleaned by experts and transported to Lynn Museum. Robin Hanley, area's museum manager for West Norfolk, said that staff will spend the following 6 months painstakingly creating mounts and supports for the individual pieces. Work on creating the Seahenge display will not begin until work on the Story of West Norfolk display is complete. Half the museum will be closed after Christmas, and work carried out on the historical journey from the Iron Age to the present day is expected to be completed by September 2007. When the display is up and running, the other half of the museum will then be closed, allowing work to begin on the Seahenge display. The display will also include audio tours of the gallery and animations illustrating the process of landscape change. This has all been funded by a £65,000 grant from the government. Ancient Welsh people from the Iron Age were defended by forts, often built on cliff-top promontories for added security. The very reason they chose these locations has now created problems today, with the narrow strips of land being eroded on both sides by the sea. A partnership between the National Trust and the Pembrokeshire Coast National Park Authority is helping to ensure that these important monuments remain safely accessible to the interested visitor while making sure they're protected from the impact of the pounding feet. At Longhouse, a promontory fort between St David's and Fishguard, the path has been routed away from the eroding cliffs. And the new footpath will also help protect the fort's ramparts. Similar concerns led to work at Porthyrau, where footpaths crossed the ramparts and ran across a crumbling clifftop. Emma Plunkett-Dillon, archaeologist for the National Trust, said that although they are very popular, such historic landmarks can't withstand the impact of large numbers of visitors, and they had to consider both where the safest route lies and how people can enjoy seeing the fort, ensuring that it will still be around for future generations to enjoy. Phil Bennett, Archaeological Heritage Manager for the National Park Authority, said that it's not just prehistoric monuments that are vulnerable to the sea. There's a long history of medieval graves eroding out of the cliffs along the National Park coastline. The strange faces drawn on the first pottery made in the South Pacific more than 3,000 years ago have always been a mystery to scientists. Now, their riddle may have been solved by new research done by two scientists to be published in the February 2007 issue of the Cambridge Archaeological Journal. What archaeologists working in the Pacific call prehistoric Lapita pottery has been found at more than 180 different places on tropical islands located in a broad arc of the southwestern Pacific, from Papua New Guinea to Samoa. Experts have long viewed the faces, sometimes sketched by ancient potters on this pottery ware, as almost certainly human in appearance, and they have considered them to be a sign that Pacific Islanders long ago may have worshipped their ancestors. John Terrell, curator of Pacific Anthropology, and Esther Schencher, a research associate, have pieced together evidence of several kinds leading to a radically different understanding of the religious life of the people in the South Pacific 3,000 years ago. Most of the mysterious faces, they report, may actually represent sea turtles. Furthermore, these ceramic portraits may be showing us ideas held by the Pacific Islanders about the origins of humankind. Terrell and Schenchter say the evidence they have assembled also shows that these religious ideas did not die when people in the Pacific stopped making Lapita pottery around 2,500 years ago. They have not only identified the expressive symbolism on prehistoric pottery excavated several years ago by Terrell and other archaeologists on an island off the Sepik coast of northern New Guinea, but they have also found this type of iconography on wooden bowls and platters collected at present-day villages on the coast that are now safeguarded in the Field Museum's rich anthropological collections. The discovery suggests that a folktale recorded by others in the early 70s, a story about a great sea turtle, the mother of all sea turtles, and the origins long ago of the first island, the first man, and the first woman on an earth, might be, in fact, thousands of years old. It now looks that they have not only deciphered the ancient Lapita code inscribed on pottery vessels in the South Pacific thousands of years ago, but by doing so may have rescued one of the oldest religious beliefs of the Pacific Islanders from the brink of oblivion. A team of archaeologists working at the Burnt City in Iran recently discovered an artificial eye at the 5,200-year-old site in Silistan, Balochistan province, southeastern Iran. The eye belonged to a woman who died when she was between 25 and 30 years old. Initial studies show traces of an abscess in the upper arch of the eye, and tracks made by the eyelid are visible on the lower part of the artificial eye. It's not clear exactly what material was used to construct it, but it seems to have been made of natural tar mixed with animal fat. The thinnest capillaries on the eyeball have been made out of gold wires with a thickness of less than 1 millimetre. The pupil of the eye has been placed in the centre of the eyeball, and some parallel lines forming an almond pattern are seen around the pupil. The eyeball has two holes in its two sides, which were used for fixing the eye into the eye socket. Some pottery works, ornamental beads, a leather bag, and a bronze mirror were also found in the grave of the woman, who was of mixed race. Studies are currently underway to glean more information about her. Covering an area of 150 hectares, Burnt City was one of the world's largest cities at the dawn of the urban era. It was built around 3200 BCE and destroyed sometime after 2100 BCE. The city had four stages of civilization and was burnt down three times, hence the name Burnt City. So, once again, can I remind people that many new archaeological and heritage employment opportunities, as well as the UK Heritage Calendar, Library and Guidance section, can be found on Badger. That's www.bajr.org. And remember that more can always be found at Stonepages, news.stonepages.com. Thanks very much for listening to Archaeology News Weekly. We hope you'll return again next week for a Christmas special.